It's called a bar song, brackets, tipsy, close brackets, and the artist is Shabuzi. Okay. Certainly a hit around the world, that one, at the moment. I think it was topping the Hot Country charts for a while, and it's been in the pop charts as well. It is 13 minutes past 12. James Ross in for Phil on The Brew, and it is that time on a Tuesday lunchtime when we talk futurology. Our resident futurologist is in the house. Maurice Misilowski is with us. How are you, Maurice?
I'm excellent. So good to have you back.
Thank you. Nice for the welcome. I much appreciate that. And you are here like a rock, giving us a gaze.
Weighing us all down.
Not at all. Gazing into the crystal ball as you normally do. And it's always interesting. You always come up with some thoughts about how things might be in the future. And one of the things that, you know, I was in the UK fairly recently for a brief visit. And one of the things that, two things I noticed, actually. There was a campaign going on under the banner of "Don't Kill Cash." That was the first thing, and that was seemed to be publicity everywhere for this. And then the other thing that I noticed in buying a coffee in certain places and certain stores, no longer can I use cash. Now, Hong Kong, I think you can pretty much use cash most places still. There are one or two places, I think, where you can't, but it seems to be pretty widespread in the UK and possibly elsewhere. And you can update us on Melbourne and Australia, certainly. But I just wonder, what is the future of money? What is the future of currencies? Are we all going to be using these e-currencies /card/tap-and-go/... whatever it is? What do you think, Maurice?
I think that it's inevitable that we will use more of the digital currencies. I've advocated for a long time, the past couple of decades, when people were absolutely positive that they were not going to use any electronic cash, that it's likely that we'll move into a less cash society rather than a cashless society. And we're finding in Australia that's pretty much the case. Since COVID was the great catalyst for this, because prior to COVID, lots of people used cash, lots of businesses accepted it, and it was kind of the norm, and we were trending towards more of them using e-commerce, but, you know, not as many. And in COVID times, in Australia, around the world, we were told not to physically touch it. I mean, physically, don't touch cash. And try and transact electronically. And, of course, it was very difficult for lots of people to get into a bank or into a physical premises to withdraw physical cash. I know it sounds obvious, but in the scheme of answering your question, that really is what's pushed us in the last couple of years, what I think would have taken us 10, 15 years otherwise, to a position where many people on the planet have lived experience now of actually using electronic cash, and that for a great number of people was something they swore they would never do. It was difficult for them to use an ATM. They didn't feel comfortable banking online. They didn't feel comfortable tap and go. It just wasn't for them. But when they had to do it, they realized that they could. So lots and lots of people had the lived experience. Lots of businesses had the lived experience of it also. They didn't need to worry about customers choosing to go somewhere else because everybody was doing it. So we have this legacy now where in Australia, I think the figure currently is about 80% of all transactions in the retail sense are done electronically.
Really? Wow.
We're down that far. And that's a huge, huge change from before when it was not half and half, but getting close to half and half of cash and credit. So we're a long way towards it. In the context of that too, Australians are pretty good at all these electronic adaptions. You know, we kind of take to them really quickly, and we always have. There's a long legacy of Australians taking up all this new stuff and playing with toys. So we were first, I think we're about the first nation that's gone that far that quickly over the period of time.
And now, what are the advantages and disadvantages? Because, I mean, there are advantages, obviously, but there's also some disadvantages. And one of the things that I do see still in Hong Kong are there quite a lot of restaurants and cafes and small stores that actually display a sign which says the opposite. We only take cash. Now, one might speculate, why is that the case? And some might say that there is some kind of avoidance going on of perhaps reporting for tax purposes, that sort of stuff. And cash, of course, makes it easier to do that, whereas if everything's run through essentially a bank of some kind, you know, there is a paper trail.
Yeah, one might say that, but neither of us would.
No, of course not.
But the reality is absolutely, as you say, that one of the reasons that we had cash, apart from the fact that it was dominant, it was ordinary, everybody used it, so all those things were in place, was that, as you said, you know, you could move cash between people without necessarily other people knowing that it had transferred. Increasingly, that's becoming difficult. The ATO, which is our Australian Taxation Office, ATO as we call them, has said to us, and a lot of it is truthful, that they now will suppose how much money the average business is supposed to have and take over, and what their takeover should be, turnover should be, sorry, was the word I was struggling for.
Sure.
And they will use artificial intelligence for that. And now it's not new. I mean, they've been doing that for about 10 years, not the artificial intelligence part, but the modelling part, which says that if you're a restaurant or a shoemaker or a gardener or a consultant, that other people in your industry are doing X, Y, Z in cash and X, Y, Z in credit, explain to us why you're not.
Right.
So they've cottoned onto it. They've made a lot of those requests and they've scared us because this is our tax time. At the end of June, we finish our financial year. So we have a lot of statements coming out, a lot of press releases coming out saying, do the right thing because we'll find out if you don't.
Mm.
So one of the many messages is exactly as you've just said, that it is obvious to us, the ATO, what your business should be doing. And we are scraping information from everywhere. Even if you're not saying you've made it, somebody else may have a receipt or something from you. So they're trying to scare us back into doing it.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure the IRD in Hong Kong is quite that advanced, or maybe they are, and I do them a disservice. But I suppose the other thing, and I don't want to tar everybody with the brush that they might be avoiding tax just because they're taking cash, but one of the other problems, I suppose, for businesses with these kind of e-currencies is often the business has to pay some kind of additional charge, right, some kind of fee.
Yeah, there's a 1% or 2% surcharge normally, and from Australia's point of view, again, in conversation, this has been in our media a lot in the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of conversation around how that's almost seen like gouging, because the average transaction, you know, if you go and buy a banh mi or if you buy a coffee or whatever, the transaction fee to tap, in other words, to use electronic, normally attracts a 1% to 2% surcharge. And the 1% to 2% surcharge has nothing to do with the amount of money it actually costs that business to do it through the banking system. It's a figure that many Australians have begun to accept as normal, a normal impost and surcharge. So there's that issue around it too. There are all sorts of problems and possibilities with this. I remember a couple of years back doing this story on ABC and having the big conversation, maybe about 10 years or so ago, about how electronic currencies might become dominant. And we got some terrific callers in, which I've never forgotten. I'm so thankful that they called in. And they were calling in from regional areas, and they were making the comment, absolutely valid, that their internet in those regional areas is terrible. Their ability to get to an ATM is impossible. They have to travel many, many, many kilometres to get to an ATM. They just can't use all this electronic stuff, even though we think they should. So for them, the notion of having folding cash is so important because they just couldn't transact their daily lives without having it. So for some people, the folding stuff, the actual physical cash, is still an imperative for them.
Yeah.
And culturally, for some people, they just have difficulty with electronics, and so they should. They should be allowed to use folding stuff or cash or coins or whatever.
If they want.
Because it makes them happy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that takes us to the Don't Kill Cash campaign in the UK that we were talking about at the start of this conversation.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. Perhaps particularly the older generation, you know, maybe they want to keep a stash of cash under the mattress. I'm not sure anybody really does that anymore, do they? But maybe they do.
Yeah, they do, because there was a figure out very recently from our RBA, which is our government regulator for cash, Royal Banking Association, that said that most of the money in circulation is, in fact, not in circulation. It's in people's hands under their mattress. They didn't say under the mattress, but I've just added that. But what they've said is that most of the cash, the physical cash that they've put out and that they normally can account for, is being held by people because they are saving it, because they feel that some kind of security to have the cash next to them or nearby or whatever. So that's an interesting point too, that for many, many people, it's just a safety thing. They feel comfortable. There's a little bit of money around that if something goes wrong or goes down, that they can actually spend or have or do.
You know, I'm often talking on Money Talk with various financial experts here on Radio 3. And one of the things that often comes up is the stability of something physical. And in the financial markets, that's generally gold. You know, if you actually hold and buy gold, that's probably the most stable. And I suppose, you know, holding a stash of cash is similar, isn't it, really? You know, you actually hold something. Whereas if you're dealing in cryptocurrencies, you know, you know, does the thing really even exist? That's possibly, you know, it is a worry.
But I used to drive my students crazy when I lectured in economics, and, you know, that I would say to them, the only reason we believe that gold has value is because we attribute value to it. It's fiat. I mean, the same with our money is that fiat means that we have attributed, as humans, we've said this has value to it. It's only really a rock. I mean, that's all that it is. So I accept that. But we see currencies around the world, we see things that have value around the world, for whatever reason, falling out of value. And it is possible, it's less possible, and in the history of humankind, gold has always stacked up well, but it is possible that we could devalue it too. It's just a fallacy that it has absolute intrinsic value.
Well, I suppose one of the sort of parallels here about people trying to attribute value to things is NFTs, this thing, non-fungible tokens. And I must admit, I've really struggled to get my head around these things. You know, it could be a photo, or it could be a piece of creative art or something. And, you know, it's bought and sold for a huge amount of value, but it's really just a digital file. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's perhaps why we do struggle. I mean, do you understand what NFTs are, Morris?
I understand what they are. I'm not sure yet that we've seen the true value of them. Mm. We saw some extreme examples in the last couple of years where literally artwork was going for $60-70 million. As you said, they're just zeros and ones. They live inside of a screen, but for whatever reason, people believe they had intrinsic value that gave them that $60-70 million US value. Over the last year or so, many of them have fallen away. That doesn't mean the notion of what it is doesn't hold. And the other thing that lots of us have been intrigued about, I think for almost the last 10 years, is cryptocurrencies, which are the digital version. You know, it's like having American, Hong Kong, Australian dollars, but various versions online.
Sure.
I did a check before we started talking. There are 13,217 cryptocurrencies currently in circulation.
Wow. I mean, the most prominent one, of course, is Bitcoin, which seems
don't we wish we all went back 10, 12 years and bought those things?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to rise and fall a lot. And it's hugely increased in value over the past 5 years or so. So, but 13,000, I had no idea.
13,217. Well, not because I know it, because I'm reading it.
Let's just cast our mind forward. You know, where do we think, Morris, in, say, 10 years' time, that we're going to be with currencies and payments particularly, not so much the crypto stuff that people are investing in, but with our day-to-day stuff? Will we still have cash, do you think, in 10 years' time?
There will be remnants of cash, and I think that's what it will be. Mm. It will be a rarity for most people and most businesses. A great number of businesses have already decided they don't want to accept it. It's too expensive, security issues. It's much easier with staffing, lots of reasons, practical reasons why they don't want it. So definitely a less cash society. I truly think that we will get down globally for most advanced economies to maybe cash taking 10%, if that, of total transactions that we have. I think it'll be sooner than 10 years, though, for many countries to get there. So most of our transactions will be done on some kind of digital format, whether that's tap and go, whether that's any kind of other digital.
And I suppose the one thing in closing, one of the things that I've noticed is that different countries, of course, have different types of electronic payment. And sometimes if you're a traveller going from one place to another, you don't necessarily have the local one. You know, we have Octopus in Hong Kong, which is purely a Hong Kong thing. We use it a lot for buying, you know, coffee or a subway fare or that sort of stuff. But I can't use that in Australia, and I can't use the Suica card from Japan in America. And WeChat is used a lot on the mainland in China for payments, but unless you're signed up for it, you can't use it. So I guess that's a problem, right?
It's a current problem. I don't think it's a long-term problem. You're right, all of these things are siloed. Mm. They're siloed because it's provided by a certain body or entity, and they only have the ability to be able to use it within a jurisdiction. But we will move, I think, slowly to digital currencies, which will be a version of, like we have an American dollar or a Hong Kong dollar, the country will actually have an e-version of it. And I think we'll move slowly towards that. There are over 100 countries, including Hong Kong, that are currently exploring some kind of possibility along those lines. And even the siloed ones you've given examples of will eventually do deals with other providers to extend out their network of use. So that will change over time too, as we now become more comfortable with these electronic payments.
Fascinating stuff. Well, look into the future as we do every Tuesday lunchtime with our resident futurologist, Morris Mislowski. Morris, thanks for talking about digital currencies today, and we'll see you same time, same place next week.